Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is John Kelly, Principal Business Advisor at Edifex, who is a nationally recognized health information exchange expert. He provides strategic consulting to Edifex customers, specializing in information exchange, and applying principles of supply chain integration to the healthcare delivery life cycle. His past experiences have included serving as CIO of healthcare network provider Navinet, has done work in Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, and at the Commonwealth of Massachusetts on the statewide HIE project, and has done his own independent consulting as well. Greetings, John, and welcome to Harlow on Healthcare.
Hi, David. Thank you for inviting me.
It is a pleasure. So I wanted to ask if you could sort of give us a thumbnail sketch of your core areas of interest these days as they relate to the changing world of health IT and health information exchange.
Well, that's a great question. I think throughout, I've done a number of different things in my career, but throughout all has been this thread of really leveraging digital information to support the improvement in the quality and efficiency of care delivery. If we go back a number of years to the early days of HIPAA, at this point about 25 years, now, there was the idea that we can improve the patient experience simply by cutting down on the administrative, as we call it today, the administrative burden associated with just accessing, getting, and processing the payments for the care. As things evolved over a number of years, we started incorporating the notion as EMRs were deployed in the industry to have the availability of structured information. Then, fast forward to today, the ability to combine the administrative data stream and the clinical data stream in the service of really being able to analyze and facilitate the quality and efficiency of the care. So I think at the heart of it is where other industries moved away from paper and into the digital world with the invention of PCs and digital exchange of information. Healthcare is significantly behind, but very quickly getting caught up.
Great. And yes, healthcare seems to be behind, and often we hear about other industries being a step ahead. Often we hear about the financial services industry as a point of comparison, saying, I can go to any ATM in the world. Why can't I have interoperable health records? Do you see us getting any closer to that sort of level of interoperability anytime soon?
Well, I do. I think the first step really came with the initiative back in the end of the Bush administration with the creation of the Office of National Coordinator of Health IT. It really took off, though. Fundamentally, if the data isn't captured in the care process in a structured way using electronic medical records, there's just no way to jump off to initiate any kind of structured data exchange. Once under the Recovery Act under Obama after he took over from Bush, he leveraged the idea of using as part of Obamacare funding the deployment of electronic medical record systems across the country, across provider offices. And I think once that played out over the course of 10 years or so, we fast forward to today where the majority of clinical care is being delivered and captured, and the data associated with that delivery is being captured in a structured way using machines. And I think that gives you the core and basic platform to do the basic use case is one that you're capturing and recording data in a way that's accessible to patients electronically, B, that providers are exchanging data with each other to care for the patient electronically, C, that you're now able to pull information together in a structured way across a population of payments so that you can actually do a much better, more effective analysis on that data. And then the final use case, which perhaps is the most important in the long run about patient-centered care, making that data directly available to patients electronically so that they can move around. And if you look at what has been done recently coming out of HHS and the feds, they have pivoted from interoperability being something that happens between payers and providers. And now interoperability is really defined by the feds as making all data available to the patients and the members. And then the member themselves becomes the agent of interoperability. And if you think about going back with that, years ago when people thought, well, if I could just have all my medical records on my ID card, then I could walk around with my ID card and then it would be available wherever I went. Well, you know, that just never played out. It was never practical. But the idea that your all of your information, both clinical and administrative, is available in a cloud, it's accessible through your mobile device. And now as you move through the care process as a patient, you can make that information available readily to anybody you as a patient want to have it. That's a whole new definition of interoperability, which is now actually becoming a reality between the recent mandates and also the ability that the information is structured and readily available with the new FHIR standards.
Right. And you're really talking about an evolution from the notion of the patient as HIE, where it's sort of operating on, what we used to call a sneaker net, but really patient as HIE, patient as the node, if you will, that can sort of decide where information can go. I guess that's certainly an improvement.
It's really no different than the rest of our lives, right? Everywhere else we walk around with all of our information in our device or in the cloud or somewhere. And when we need it, we access it and we provide it to whoever we want. This is really just healthcare catching up to the rest of the world.
Right. So robotic process automation. Tell me about robotic process automation. What does that mean? How is that relevant to the conversation?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think it first started popping up in a big way a couple of years ago, the idea of robotic process automation generally. I think Gartner was one of the analysts that really started pushing the idea that this was going to be a component that would revolutionize a number of industries. I think it started, going back to referencing, my earlier observations about what we're trying to do with administrative simplification was really just a supply chain integration in any other industry. But the difference is that, we talked about administrative simplification. We found out that you can't simplify a complex process. It's not doable. It was unrealistic to think we could simplify things that were complex. What we then found is, well, maybe we can make complex things easy by automating them. And so the idea when we started thinking about HIPAA transactions and electronic claims and prior auth and eligibility, we started to be able to say, how can we incorporate digital data into human processes to be able to really facilitate, demystify the complexity, make things better, faster, cheaper. Well, if you fast forward to today and you think about what's capable now with machine learning and artificial intelligence, you're not just automating a human process and making it easier for people to get things done. Now you're saying I can take whole sections of a process and really use machines to talk to one another and resolve a complex situation down to an easy machine process. And maybe the best example of that everybody hopes for, it's the holy grail for 20 years, is prior authorization. If you think about the implementation guides, the recent directions that CMS has set forth in the proposed rules, in the rule that was frozen with the change in the administration, and something will happen in sometime, presumably over the next few months. The idea that we can use FHIR, use structured data, use query, use analytics with machine learning and artificial intelligence to actually make what the Weedy prior authorization report called single action order entry. A provider just says into the EMR, keys in, I want Mrs. Jones to have a head CAT scan. And then at that point, machines check eligibility, machines check the algorithm for appropriate use, machines check all the other things related to the network and the provider. And then the machine just comes back to the physician and says, okay, approved, not approved, or I need to get a little more information, right? That idea that you can do machine queries for the patient information that's in the medical record so that that 14 to 16 hours a week that the AM is saying that every provider in the country is spending on prior authorization, that's not done by the machines in front of them. I mean, that's what robotic process automation is about. And that has played out and has proven to be true and valuable in almost every other industry over the last 5-6 years. And I think healthcare is really catching on. Epic is literally talking about, as they're building workflows for their patients in their, especially their larger facilities, they're actually using the term robotic process automation to look at how they can automate workflows and make it easier for providers to focus on patient care and less on all the administrative that surrounds that, and also less on spending less money on the staff that have to support them in doing mundane tasks that are capable of being automated. That makes sense?
Absolutely. And I think that resonates with anybody, whether you're in healthcare and direct healthcare services or not. There are certainly many things where we want to let the machines do what the machines are good at and let the humans, you know, quote unquote, practice at the top of their license rather than being reduced to dealing with the administrivia, as you say. And that's been a perpetual complaint of folks within the healthcare system. And hopefully this is a glimmer of light moving away from that past. Are there other benefits that you would point to for robotic process automation?
Well, I think especially when you move more into real ML and you know, or machine learning and artificial intelligence, Google's been saying for a few years, you know, talking about the possibility of being able to look for treatments for cancer, for example, right? It's, if we look back at the when people first started studying the human genome and they talked about mapping, they were talking about taking 20 years to map out the human genome. And then along comes an entrepreneur and says, well, I'm just going to use Cray supercomputers and line up a bunch of them, and I'm going to knock it off in 2 or 3 years, which did happen. I think, you know, that cancer research for all kinds of orphan conditions and things like that, the grunt work and the investment that has to be made in pulling a tiny population set of data together and then finding the subtle patterns and the, you know, the weak signals that are in that data, it's a difficult, time-consuming, expensive task. Well, if you think about if data is structured on patients, if the actual treatment results are being captured in every clinical trial and every clinical study, and if those can be securely and with respect for privacy brought together, which, you know, the Mayo Clinic and John Holomka and Google and Optum, they're looking at ways to do that now. If those data can be brought in to be able to look at very large population sets, then being able to deploy the tools of AI and ML and robotic process automation to that grunt work that used to be done by people in cubes with keyboards, with fingers on keyboards, if you replace that human effort focused just finding the subtle patterns and then letting the people begin to test out those observations made by the machines, then, you know, we really could very, you know, conceivably come up with cures of many forms of cancer just based on the information we now know without doing any more further research. It's kind of amazing, but it is part of what's possible, I think, when you start to look at how machines can help us get work done that we just couldn't get done because we didn't have enough people and time and money to support that work.
If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guest today is John Kelly of EdFX. John, you've said a lot just there, and I want to dig in a little bit. Number one, there has been to date some work along the lines of what you're talking about, and sort of aggregating information from across multiple locations, individual records of people with rare diseases. You mentioned Mayo, and that brings to mind the SCAD study with spontaneous cardiac artery dissection issues that were sort of very rare conditions and spread out over the world, and there was no real way to pull that information together without sort of social media connections, and then the data was able to be aggregated. I think you're talking about something a little bit different, about even sort of without the need for the human interaction and initiating those conversations, sort of trolling through the mountains of data that we collect in order to identify some, to change that, to transform that data into information, into knowledge, into insights. And I think that's a very exciting new frontier. I guess I would ask if you could speak to the question of how that works and sort of how is that different from, for example, the Watson Health approach, which seems to be, you know, shuttered at this point. How is this going to work when that didn't work? And I understand that some of the Watson Health issues were around, well, there needs to be some human direction. And if you have predispositions in certain direction in terms of the way you're thinking about things, then you put certain blinders on the machine and the machine isn't going to necessarily learn something new. Are you really talking about letting the machine loose on the collected corpus of data that's out there, or, you know, how does this work? How is this better?
Well, I think it's different. I think there was kind of an idea. I think the idea of Watson, you know, and some of it's just kind of cultural and political, but the idea that we would amass huge quantities of population data and that there would be a big brother in the sky that knew everything about everybody. And then Watson would be smart enough to play the game of checks and execute and then win the game, you know, where the decision-making by a computer would replace the decision-making, the insight, the sensitivities, the art of medicine, that would be done by a human being. I think whether it's possible or not, you know, we could debate that. Whether it's culturally acceptable, I think at this point in time, I don't think that it is. And I think that was part of, you know, take the technical challenges that were difficult to overcome out of the equation. I think, are people ready to just interact with a machine instead of a doctor or nurse or whatever? I'm not sure. I suspect no, we're not, and that has something to do with the resistance. But when we're talking about robotic process automation, we're not talking about that. We're talking about where the machines are truly assisting in the process. That when I talked about, you know, the machines aren't going to cure cancer, the machines aren't going to make decisions about cancer. What the machines are going to do is find these subtle patterns that are easily missed by a set of human eyes. Right, to the weak signals, the little tiny little says, hey, there's a correlation here that was missed by a human being, because the machines can spend 24/7 and huge amounts of processing power looking at huge amounts of data. Suddenly, you know, the act of machine learning, which is an iterative process, will highlight something, and the act of artificial intelligence will say, is that relevant to the question? And then the machine can amass all of that and put it in front of a set of human beings or a set of researchers and say, you might want to look at this, right? That's one use case where I think it is very different from what was seemed to be the dream of the Watson type approach. I think the other is even more mundane, but maybe as realistic, is just the ability of machines to do the grunt work, real robotic process automation. We have machines building cars now, right? Doing jobs that humans used to do, but then humans are still involved in the process at a different level and in a different way. And so if you think about, I guess you mentioned the Mayo earlier, I heard, I think it was John Holomko was speaking about some of the things they're doing there. One thing very simple is with COVID emerging, the idea that someone can write a piece of software, I guess this is being tested right now, where the watch has just enough sensors in it to be able to track variations in temperature, variations in characteristics of the blood and whatnot, enough to put together a profile looking at large populations of patients to say, hey, if a bunch of students on a campus are all wearing Apple Watches, we can be monitoring them in real time and saying, hey, this looks like it might be a COVID case. Send this person for a test. So I think what it comes down to is, you know, when you look at the Watson model, it's let's get all the data together. I call it, you know, healthcare data at rest model. Right? We think of healthcare data at rest or in motion really from a privacy point of view. When you think about it from like every other industry, that you can analyze data at rest in big data, you know, technology from the last decade, and then draw conclusions and run algorithms. This is actually applying logic to data in motion. Healthcare, you know, vital signs, the Internet of Things, all of this data that's constantly fluid, constantly moving. You can have, you know, light logic on the wire, sniffing signs and saying, hey, you might want to look at this. You might want to look at this. You might want to do this. Or I can accumulate this. I can create an email message or an IM, and I can push it to a student saying, hey, I just noticed that this was going on with you. You might want to go to the student health center and get yourself tested for COVID, or at the very least, check your temperature, right? So these are the robotic process automation. Maybe the distinction is more around, it's a little more mundane and it's replacing just rudimentary tasks. But it's really becomes as a human augmentation to make it to make what we do more effective and more efficient. I don't know. Does that help explain where I'm going with this?
It does. It does. And it sounds very promising. And I guess the question is, are we talking about the bleeding edge here? How long until this is sort of adopted in the mainstream?
Well, if you look at, I'm sure many people in the audience are familiar with HL7, the fire accelerators, projects like Argonaut, DaVinci, Codex. You know, the DaVinci workgroup's been working for a couple of years on different use cases, one of which is clinical alerts and notifications. So just the ability of the machines to be able to gather the ADT messages, some of the results, structured information from CCDAs, fire transactions that are coming through, connected to the Internet of Things. I mean, there are real production level demonstrations going on right now with people leveraging the fire standards, leveraging the notification and the quality metrics in implementation guides, and producing real results, feeding you know, creating workflows and user applications that tie this data to some logic that automates the communication of important information and events directly with consumers through their mobile devices. So it's not just a promise. You know, it's like I said, it's a little more rudimentary. It's just kind of, you know, it's someone to help you wash the dishes, maybe not cook the meal. But, you know, that having someone help you wash the dishes actually takes a lot of load. Maybe
that's okay. That's a good start. Yeah, right. Interesting analogy. I like it. So what do you think the time horizon is to getting to that next level, you know, and or even to the level beyond that when we have sort of the personal chef, not the personal dishwasher?
Well, you know, the personal chef might still be, you know, 5 to 7 years away. But I think our ability to cook a much more extensive meal without having to worry about how many pans we dirty is starting to show up in the next, you know, year or two. There's, like I said, there's real production demonstrations going on. The goal of a number of the HL7 accelerator groups and with the, you know, carrots and sticks being provided by CMS and OMC, there's money and investment tied to this. You know, that haven't talked at all about the fact that with cheap money, the amount of venture capital being poured into the opportunities that are being created by structured data moving in healthcare, it's huge. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. What I alluded to with the Apple Watch, my understanding is, you know, the Mayo Clinic alone has, you know, a number of hundreds of millions of dollars of investment capital at the ready to support some of these processes that they want to automate with their care delivery network. So I think we're seeing right now some real world examples of robotic process automation in healthcare. Certainly, prior authorization, we will be seeing fundamental changes and results within the next 24 months. There's no doubt in my mind about that. So the results are starting to come online as we speak. And I would say within 24 months, there's going to be real changes in the way care is delivered, at least in pockets of the United States. And ironically, some will be urban, you know, the places you expect in the huge medical centers. Other places, it will be with, you see, with telehealth and telemedicine already. We're starting to talk about digital therapeutics. I think there's going to be a significant amount of investment in
also rural and less sophisticated parts of the country as well. So these results are real. It's a mentor of mine in the past said, this is a rock in the air. It will hit the ground. It's just, you know, when and where.
Very encouraging and very, it's really something we can all look forward to. I guess looking beyond this specific realm and more broadly in healthcare innovation, I guess I would ask if you were to wake up tomorrow and find yourself 5 years in the future, what is something in healthcare that you would either hope or maybe expect to find has changed dramatically?
Well, what I fully expect to see, you know, I think within the community, all these changes, we still view interoperability as primarily something between the major stakeholders, payers, providers, government. I think we would view it maybe still as a little bit of a paternalistic model of healthcare delivery. What the feds have done with the release of information through APIs to patients, members, you know, the citizens. There's this phrase, Anish Chopra, who was CIO at the White House under Obama early on, who did the early work that set the stage for the blue button. He talks a lot about what's being referred to as the health app economy. And I think 5 years from now, where a lot of people are thinking there's going to be maybe, you know, 15, 20, 100 apps that patients are using, they're sponsored by providers and payers, that's not the situation. There's going to be closer, maybe 100,000 apps, very targeted towards specific patient needs. And not just will patients be walking around with their data and be an agent of interoperability, patients themselves will make their data available to this health app economy, which will generate tremendous amount of value for patients. It is going to fundamentally change the relationship that patients currently have with the providers and the provider network and with their insurers and with everybody else. There's going to, you know, the idea of patient-centered care or consumerism in healthcare, we haven't, as a healthcare industry and community, we haven't really wrestled with what it means to be a consumer in any other industry. It's going to drive change. When you think about consumerism and the effects, say, for example, with CAT scans, we keep wrestling with controlling the demand for CAT scans because they're so expensive. If you look at the PC, when PCs were $2,000, they didn't say, let's limit the number of people who can buy PCs. They said, how do we make a PC cost $200 instead of $2,000, right? That's going to be the way that, and I think this will happen within 5 years just because the way app economies develop. And if you listen to Anish Chopra and some of the other visionaries on this, that's exactly what they're predicting. And that's exactly what a lot of these venture capitalists who have the money to roll the dice on are thinking as well.
Well, we'll all stay tuned. It's certainly an interesting ride for all of us. Thank you, John.
You're very welcome. Really appreciate the opportunity today.
My pleasure. You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.